This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. The fourth annual Babe Fest Music Festival returns to Southwest Florida this Friday and Saturday. The event celebrates diversity in the arts through a full lineup of women-focused and women-fronted bands. The event's founder and organizer, musician Angela Page, returns to our studios for a preview of the two-night event, and Rox Revolt performs live in studio. She fronts the glam punk rock band Rox Revolt and the Velvets, which will be performing tomorrow night at the event's Fort Myers venue. WGCU's Rachel Iacovone takes the host chair for that conversation coming up later this hour. But first, the city of Fort Myers went through a dramatic metamorphosis in the early 20th century from a largely frontier cow town to a thriving metropolitan center of commerce, citrus production, and of course, tourism. The latest book from Southwest Florida historian and author Tom Hall explores that development through the lens of a series of major fires that nearly derailed the city's development. In Volume 2 of Epic Fires of Fort Myers, How a Series of Early Fires Influenced the Town's Development, Hall focuses in on four major blazes and a handful of smaller fires that shaped the city just during a 14-month span between January of 1914 and the end of February in 1915. In addition to the first volume of Epic Fires of Fort Myers, which came out last year, Hall also co-authored the book Female Pioneers of Fort Myers. He's also a journalist and tireless advocate of the arts, serving as the City of Fort Myers public art consultant. In that capacity, he advises the city's public art committee on administration of the city's collection. And you can keep up with a vast array of the region's arts offerings through his website, artswfl.com. Tom Hall, welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. Always great to connect with you.
Thank you, John. It's great to be here.
And we're also joined by retired Fort Myers Fire Department Chief Richard Chappelle, whose analysis and fire safety tips are also included in both volumes of the book. Chief Chappelle's firefighting career spans more than three decades. He served as chief of the Fort Myers Fire Department between 1995 and 2006. He's a third-generation firefighter and a fifth-generation Lee County resident. Chief Chappelle, thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Well, thank you so much, John. I do appreciate it.
And as always, I invite listeners to join the conversation. The number to call is 877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. On Facebook, we're at WGCU Public Media. On Twitter, we're at WGCU using the hashtag GCL. Now, Tom, the first volume of the book takes us back to the late 1800s and the fire that destroyed Fort Myers' only schoolhouse at the time. And that covers a somewhat broader stretch of time, whereas, as I just mentioned, this newly published book covers just this 14-month span between 1914 and 1915. Does that speak to, you know, perhaps a more rapid pace of development that was occurring at that time compared to previous decades?
Yeah, it definitely did. In that span of time, and this is, I think, one of the virtues of Volume 2 of the book, basically the entire town was being made over. And I liken it to a real-life game of Monopoly. And the key players were Harvey Heitman, Walter Langford, a county commissioner by the name of nicknamed Wild Bill Tolles, and another gentleman who most people never heard of, Peter Tonlier. And in the span of this, between 1911 and February of 1915, virtually all of the city block between Hendry and Jackson down on First Street was completely made over. All the buildings that were there had been torn down and brand new buildings were put up. And fortunately, those buildings are still there today.
It's interesting because you might want to look at that as kind of a collaborative effort of these influential figures, these businessmen. But in reality, it was more of a competition.
It was definitely a competition. It turned out that Harvey Heitman and Walter Langford really had bad blood between each other. Hmm. And so part of what motivated them was a game of one-upmanship. And because Bill Tolles sided with Langford, he got involved in the mix. And actually, Harvey Heitman even tried to derail his efforts to build what's was the Lee County Courthouse and is today the county commission chambers.
Gotcha. And we're going to get more into those details in a minute. First, I just wanted to ask, I guess at what point in creating this book did you realize, oh, this is going to be two books? Was it part of like a single broader research effort and you're just like, I have too much information, this has got to be two books?
Exactly. As we talked about last time I was on, I ensconced myself in the microfilm room at the Fort Myers Library, and I read every edition of the Fort Myers Press for the 6 months leading up to each fire and the 6 months following the fire. And as I started to accumulate information, it just became abundantly clear that it really needed to be published in two volumes, not only because of the difference in time frame, but really to draw attention to what was happening in Fort Myers during this epochal 1914 to 1915 period as far as making over the commercial district in the town.
Yeah, I can really appreciate that thorough technique of looking at not just the Sentinel events themselves, but the 6 months prior and the 6 months after. And you can certainly see that reflected in the detail of the book. And I would strongly advise anybody who's reading the book to not do what I started doing, where you skip over the footnotes. Read the footnotes as you go along. It provided so much rich texture. And again, you talk about these microfilm archives, a wonderful resource having these articles from the Fort Myers Press. But at the same time, are there drawbacks to relying or having to rely on journalism accounts?
The obvious drawback is that the journalism standards of that day are materially different from what they are today. Unfortunately, many of the questions that I had were never asked or answered. There were no interviews of the people that were involved in these fires. There were no follow-up stories. And there were never any follow-ups on the possible origin or cause of the fires. So unfortunately, the historical record is woefully inadequate in answering a lot of these questions. And unfortunately, there really aren't any other sources, whether at the Southwest Florida Historical Society or the Museum of History, that do any better job than the Fort Myers Press.
Did you also run into an issue of maybe reporters kind of purporting their own theories or theories that might be less likely but are perhaps more salacious and headlines might sell more copies?
Well, certainly that was the case in the first volume. Mm-hmm. It certainly was the case with the schoolhouse fire that gave rise to Lee County breaking away from Monroe. But by the time we get to volume two in this 1914 to 1915 time period, they really didn't advance any theories in terms of cause of fire. The cause of fire was virtually never mentioned, and there were no follow-up stories or interviews ever conducted, or at least that were ever printed.
All right. Well, in the setup to the first fire you cover in this book, the citrus packing plant fire, you really paint this vivid picture for us of how different, how vibrant the downtown waterfront area was at that time. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what it would have looked like compared to what it looks like today?
Right. Well, not being a Fort Myers native, I was blown away by the research as well. When I started that part of the book, I had no idea that in the 1900s, Fort Myers was more of a port than it was a business district. And what the port looked like, there were these six long piers that extended from the riverbank into the Caloosahatchee River. There was one for the train station. There was the city dock and another dock for the steamship line. And even the Royal Palm Hotel had a 840-foot pier that extended into the river. But sandwiched between the railroad pier and the steamship line, what they called the Ireland Dock at the time, was this massive 500-foot pier that contained that housed this citrus packing plant. And so if you were coming into Fort Myers by train as you came over the trestle, your first appearance was there's this thriving port. And really all of the activity, especially between January and the end of March of each year, everything was centered on what was going on the river.
All right. And I guess let's talk about the lead up to, what happened the day of the Lee County packing plant fire. Because I didn't realize this either until I was reading your book. Nightlife along the waterfront, the riverfront, was pretty active too. There was a carousel there. And it really just kind of seemed to draw everybody out.
Yes. And that particular day, the fire started in the evening. And that particular day, there was a carousel in the midway. And so there weren't a whole lot of entertainment options back at that point. And so virtually everyone in town turned out for the midway.
All right. And so I guess tell us about just what happened with the Lee County packing plant fire, because pretty significant destruction there.
It was. And Fort Myers caught a tremendous break because there had been a cold front that had passed through that week. But then there was a warm front that swept as the cold front kind of retreated back up the peninsula, a warm front followed. And so that particular night, the wind was blowing from the south to the north. And the packing plant was a massive building. It was 250 feet deep by 160 feet across. And the theory is, and we got this from the newspaper reports of at least interviews with the plant manager. He theorized, although Harvey Heitman equivocated, he theorized that one of his workmen must have thrown a lit cigarette into the clothes hamper when he took off his apron. In any case, the fire started fairly quickly. They did have an on-site pump, but they got so nerved up by how quickly the fire was spreading that they started it incorrectly and it malfunctioned. And within no time at all, this entire huge plant is now burning fiercely. There, on the same dock where the packing house was located, there was a marine ways called Lofton Marine Shop, and it had a number of yachts and other vessels that were tied to it that were under repair. And all of those facilities caught fire and essentially burned to the waterline. But what didn't happen is, because the wind was blowing out towards the river, the adjoining pier called Ireland's Dock not only had the steamship offices, but it was where the Gulf refinery kept its storage tanks. And there were three tanks that had a total of 15,000 gallons of highly flammable fuel. And if those had exploded, in all probability, it would have killed hundreds of people that had flocked to the waterfront to watch the fire. But it probably would have also leveled, if not the entire business district, even a good portion of the residential communities.
Wow. So it would have been a very different – probably a story we all would know if it had just been a day later or a day – wow.
Tampa Tribune reported on the packing house fire, they incorrectly stated that the entire city had burned down.
Wow.
Had the fuel tanks exploded, that would have been an accurate story.
Yeah. Well, and really, I'm not trying to make excuses for a paper getting something that wrong, but the concept of an entire town being lost to fire wouldn't have been that unusual.
It was actually fairly commonplace at the time.
Yeah. Chief Chappelle, I know that you didn't write the afterword analysis on this particular chapter, and for that, of course, you know, we can turn to Fire Marshal Jennifer Campbell, but she kind of seemed to focus in her commentary there on explaining why, you know, a lot of times people find fire regulations and zoning codes and whatnot sort of onerous, but she's like, hey, this is the reason we have this stuff. This is what prevents these kinds of tragedies. Can you maybe speak more to, I guess, her line of thought there?
Sure. I mean, fire codes and regulations, zoning regulations, like the fuel tanks, wouldn't be allowed today. They'd either have to be off-site and it'd be pumped in. They'd be underground. They'd be protected. But a lot of people do feel that it's like the last thing, the last hurdle they have to overcome is the fire codes. And they see them as expensive. And you go back in history to the larger cities, whether it's the fire in Chicago or these theater fires in New York with large loss of life. Most fire codes and building codes come out of a disaster, and I think a lot of people feel, okay, it happened. Lightning struck. Can't strike again. And it always strikes again. Otherwise, thank you, I would not have had a job for a career or – you know, and there's always that problem out there. And people just look at it as just – you know, they resist us. They appeal. They fight it, and then oftentimes afterwards they see the value, especially in insurance reduction.
Sure, sure.
And following up on Chief Chappelle's comment about lightning does strike twice and it does happen again, we start the book with the packing house fire. But in the epilogue, we end the book with the fact that the packing house burned down not one more time but twice again. It burned down again for a second time in 1939. And then it burned down for the final time in 1954, and we were lucky enough to find a gentleman who had an historic photograph, and we put that picture on the book. And at that time, speaking of those storage tanks, they were still there.
Oh, my gosh.
And when the fire department arrived on the scene of the 54 fire, they could hear the petrol inside of the tanks boiling. It was that close. In fact, they were concerned that they weren't going to be able to get water on it fast enough to prevent it from exploding.
Wow. Wow. And Tom, can we talk about how the, you know, sort of the firefighting infrastructure changed or perhaps didn't change between the events in the second volume of the book and the events in the first? Because, you know, folks who read the first or heard that conversation last fall might remember us talking about this. I don't remember the exact word, but this contraption that had to be hand pumped to get water to come out of it. And of course, you know, these are things that would either have to be horse drawn or pushed, or, you know, it wasn't something that could move. It didn't have it wasn't like a modern fire engine.
Well, as Chief Chappelle can certainly expand upon, the Fort Myers Fire Department, unfortunately, has usually been chronically undercapitalized and undermanned. Not much had changed between Volume 1 and Volume 2. When Volume 2 starts in January of 1914, the hand pumper was still in use. We did have a fire engine, but it was horse-drawn. We still did not have a motorized fire engine. And actually, the city council did not see the wisdom of ordering a motor-driven fire engine until after the Hotel Michigan fire that destroyed most of what is present-day Patio de Leon. Okay. So we were still using fairly antiquated equipment throughout the whole time frame of Volume 2, throughout the whole 1914-1915 epic.
Well, and Chief Chappelle, I will ask you to piggyback on that. I mean, because, you know, your experience in the firefighting is, you know, spans three decades. We just heard Tom Hall talking about, you know, officials not really seeing the need for these important preventative measures. Did you kind of have to fight those same sort of fights throughout your career?
Well, coming up through the ranks of the department, we had a lot of almost built in-house fire trucks, you know, cabin chassis, engine and all that. But we put the bodies on them and welded the water tanks on. We started purchasing Class A fire engines, one in 1963, two in 1975. And to the city's credit, at this point in time, they do have six stations within the city, and they all have Class A fire engines that they're all good. The other thing the city did in the last 20 years is really upgraded the municipal water system. It's the same water system that provides potable water. They increased the size of the mains, the spacing of the hydrants. So that part of the infrastructure is in place, but it still takes people. And personnel is 90% of your budget. Right. And if you don't see them on a fire every day, there's always that question, you know, the bang for the buck, which is why fire departments throughout the country, including Fort Myers, provides paramedic service and other services with the same group of firefighters to get that. But yeah, I mean, to this day, we're still could use a couple of more trucks and definitely more staffing to bring us back to a level of even 5, 6, 7 years ago with the growth of the city and the population. It's just a constant battle.
And Tom, I'm kind of like reading between the lines here, and I feel like maybe your sarcasm font was on when you talk about the takeaway from that fire being not that all of these piers and infrastructure on the water not be made completely out of wood, but that they need a fire tug. And I think that kind of – I wanted to bring that up because that kind of plays into the next fire in the story. And this, of course, involves, you know, the loss of the Mildred. And then before that, of course, there was a commercial vessel that had a horrible accident, the Planner. Can you tell me about what happened there? Because – and also I just want to commend you on the way you've put together this narrative. It really feels like you're – it's almost like a screenplay, reading the way you've put these accounts together of what people experienced.
Well, terrific. I appreciate that. I strive very hard to make this entertaining as well as informative. As far as the Planner was concerned, it was a fairly large steamship. It was the second that this Wild Bill Tolles had purchased for his steamship line, and he had great plans for it. But on that particular night, They did a little excursion, and because of the fact that there was low tide, they weren't able to complete the excursion. So they came up and they docked, and they only had one mate that was left on board. And he heard a sound that he didn't like coming from what they call the fire room, which was the furnace room. And when he opened the door, he was met with a sheet of flame. And being the only guy on board, there was virtually no way for him to put the fire out. He did fight it for about an hour before finally giving up the ghost. And of course, the ship burned to the waterline. In all probability, and we see this happening even today on pleasure craft with inboard motors, if you're operating in shallow water and you suck stuff into your impeller, it can create a clog or it could cause damage. And in this particular case, there was a pan underneath the furnace that in all probability cracked, and that's what caused the fire. But when the ship burned to the ground, it took out half of Fort Myers' steamboat capabilities to ferry passengers back and forth to Key West and Tampa and St. Pete.
Wow. And if I remember correctly, this was also a fire where, they could see it from shore. The volunteer firefighters came and just kind of had to throw their hands up because although they could see the boat, it was too far away for them to actually do anything.
Yeah, the boat was 300 yards offshore, and of course their hoses wouldn't reach that far.
Right. Shortly thereafter, then there's the story of the Mildred. This is just absolutely frightening to put myself in the shoes of somebody who would have been on that boat. Middle of the night, I guess early in the morning, it's foggy. What happens?
Yeah, I don't know if fellow historian Amy Bennett Williams is listening this afternoon, but this is her favorite story.
Okay.
And what happens is the Mildred is the Tull Steamship Line other steamboat, and it was their workhorse. And it just so happens that this is the night of the Patio de Leon fire. So in the morning, Patio de Leon burns down. We have 11 buildings, and the business district almost is incinerated. And then that night, the Mildred takes off. Bill Toll's wife, Billy, and a couple of other people. And it takes off for Tampa in the middle of the night. And it's dark. It's foggy. And apparently there was a schooner laden with lumber that was en route from Tampa Bay to Cuba. And it ran into the Mildred broadside. And the Mildred now has a gaping hole. They're 5 miles offshore. They're in 50 feet of icy cold water, and the ship is going down. And the captain, a guy named Nick Armida, makes the command decision, and he tells his crew, we're going to run full out from where we're at towards shore. His hope is he can make shore and ground and beach the boat and save the boat that way. But unfortunately, he only makes about 2 miles before the boat actually goes down. But fortunately, by then, they were in 15 feet of water. And as the boat is sinking, it contacts the bottom, and it just sits there. And that's what allowed the crew and the passengers to be rescued.
Wow. Yeah, that's an incredible story. And, of course, as it's moving, it's not taking on water as quickly, so you wouldn't want to just be sitting out there waiting to sink, or it'll happen more quickly.
Well, and imagine the plight of the engineer and his staff. They're in the boiler room, which is below deck. And this water's gushing in, and they're trying to keep the fire going, and they're up to their chest in icy cold water as the boat's taking on more and more seawater.
Wow, incredible. Chief Chappelle, you kind of write the afterword analysis on what happened with the planner in that chapter, and fittingly, because this is National Safe Boating Week, tell us a bit about your analysis on that, and perhaps what the takeaway would be for us here in Southwest Florida today.
Sure. I mean, we're one of the pleasure boat capitals of the world, and it seems like just about everybody has a boat. And if they don't plan for fire or think fire will always happen to someone else or the accident will always happen to someone else, and you're out offshore and you don't have to be but a few hundred yards out off of Sanibel and have a problem and be by yourself, it becomes a major issue. And fire is the major issue of any ship. Imagine fire on a submarine or a naval ship. They practice for that. And one of the things we talk about is whatever the recommended size and type of the fire extinguisher on your boat, double it. It's really not going to be that much bigger. The first time you squeeze those handles together to see how it, you're probably working with it for the first time, and you've just expended over half of your extinguishing agent, you know, and maybe up into the air or whatever. Now you've got just a little bit left, and this fire is growing. You've got to get this thing under control. One that's double the size is just a few dollars more, and it actually is double the rating. It's not that much bigger. But to have your life preservers, know where they are. I mean, be ready to put them on and stay with the boat as long as you can. But obviously, if it's on fire, you're going to have to get in the water in case that fire is going to spread because of the fuel. But stay with the boat because the Coast Guard and now the Marine teams that the fire departments all have and coordinate with, City of Cape Coral, Iona MacGregor, Fort Myers Beach, Sanibel, and City of Fort Myers all have boats now. Along with the Coast Guard. And they practice regularly on the same radio frequencies and dispatch vessels from those departments to the single incident so they can get out there and work the fire or sinking boat and scour the area for the survivors.
And you write about this also. What is it about the manufacturing of boats today, the materials used, that makes it perhaps more dangerous than it would have been in years past?
I mean, everybody thinks wooden boat, great wood and all, but it floats and it burns. But the fiberglass today and the composite materials they use. And think of the composite materials in your home. Generally, the house itself is not the problem. It's the furnishings. Well, all these foam rubbers and plastics. There are plastics today that when they burn give off the same dioxin that was used as the principal agent in Agent Orange, the defoliant used in Vietnam. And with our veterans coming back from Vietnam with the cancer they have from there, I mean, these byproducts, and they just passed a bill in the in Florida government that if there are certain types of cancer that firefighters get now, it is automatically presumed to be caused by line of duty. Right. It's just a so if you're in it, there's a chance that you're going to have it as well. So these materials they're using in construction today and furnishings on boats and houses, that's the real problem.
Yeah, yeah. And they burn faster and they burn hotter,
a lot hotter.
Wow. Yeah. Well, and I want to give a shout out to Chief Financial Officer Jimmy Patronis for really advocating hard for that bill
yes,
that you were
did.
Talking about that passed. And of course, just a wonderful thing to do for the folks who put their lives on the line for us.
And by the way, I don't ever hesitate or tire of pointing this out, but one of the women that we've dedicated this book to is a firefighter who lost her life to cancer.
Right. Right. We are about out of time for this segment, but of course, I want to bring up again the fact, Tom, that this book, you know, of course, being as engaging as it is, was a bit of a labor of love, and that there was a lot of folks who contributed to a GoFundMe that you had to actually get this financed and get this published, which is just a really wonderful thing to see that there were so many folks who were interested in seeing this brought to life and who have an interest in local history. Do you feel like the local history community here in Southwest Florida is particularly strong?
I do. I think that there is definitely a real interest in our local history. And I think that's fueled by the fact that when you're downtown, we still have all of those historic buildings. Hmm. If you've ever passed one of those buildings or eaten dinner there or you work there and you've wondered, well, who built that or why was it built or what was it like when it was first put up? You'll find those answers in the book.
Right, right. And again, you just have to tell us that the book is available. Where can folks pick up a copy?
You can pick up a copy from True Tours in the Franklin Shops on First Street and certainly on Amazon.com.
All right. Well, that is all the time we have for this portion of the show, and we barely scratched the surface of the stories that are in this book, which I'm okay with. I don't want to ruin it for anybody out there. But thanks so much to my guest, author and historian Tom Hall. Again, his latest book, the second volume of Epic Fires of Fort Myers, How a Series of Early Fires Influenced the Town's Development, is now available. Tom Hall, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Hey, I appreciate it, and thanks for your interest in the topic.
Also, thanks to retired Fort Myers Fire Department Chief Richard Chappelle. His analysis and fire safety tips are included in both volumes of the book. Great to meet you and speak with you today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're taking a short break, but when we return, WGCU's Rachel Iacovone takes the host chair to explore the upcoming 4th annual Babe Fest Music Festival, and we'll hear a live performance from featured musician Rox Revolt. I'm John Davis, and you're listening to Gulf Coast Live. Stay with us.